The word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Revelation chapter 7, where we are ready to resume with verse 1. All right, as we have seen, the eternal God has a certain amount of intrinsic glory that is just by virtue of his person and who he is. That cannot change. However, the particulars of history as we know them are designed to further the glory of God. And this is done through the principle of grace and redemption, and of course then as creatures of their own free will determined to orient to God, this brings further glory to him from external sources. We recognize that this is what the plan is all about, that God has designed all of this that we see, that we hear, the entire principles of the angelic conflict to glorify himself and to advance his purposes that were eternal with him under the principles of the divine decrees. So to that end, we are here to study his word, recognizing that this is the only way we can orient to him is through an understanding of his word, and of course, as taught under the proper principles, using the correct procedures and all of that, the word of God is able to be understood. So obviously it's not understood by those out of fellowship, however, so it's time to deal with the principle of rebound. And, of course, whatever else you need to do so that you can put aside distractions and focus your attention and concentrate on what we have today. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we recognize that all that we are and all that we have and all that we see comes from your hand, that you are the eternal creator who has all things under control, that nothing in human history has surprised you in any way or taken you aback since you have made provision for everything based on the principle of your foreknowledge and understanding of what exactly would occur. We thank you that we will end up winning in the end of all of this. And pray, of course, that we would manifest sufficient positive volition to avail ourselves of the great blessings that you have for those who diligently seek you. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are ready here now to move on. Technically, we might say here, we are going to be at a parenthesis with respect to the opening of the six seals, or seven of them actually. As we have pointed out, the seals are all opened initially, very quickly, at the outset of Daniel's 70th week, following the translation of the church to heaven at the rapture. The seven seals are all opened here. However, these seven seals are comprised of various forms of information and various things that do not necessarily take place right away, but occur at various points throughout Daniel's 70th week, and not just occur in an isolated sense of a momentary occurrence, but stretch over, in some cases, months and weeks and even years, as we have seen. So, for instance, the first seal, which deals with the appearance of Antichrist, really covers the entire 7 years. He will be on the planet all that time. Now, obviously, at the midpoint, he changes, in a sense, because he becomes indwelt by Satan. The second seal that really began with the outbreak of global warfare really doesn't take place until just before the midpoint. And then, of course, it extends. There's going to be warfare from then on out, pretty much. This is the beginning of the Armageddon campaign, which is an extended period of 3.5 to 4 years of intensive warfare, and all that that brings with it. As we saw, some of the third seal is the fallout from this, and economic conditions will continue to be difficult right on through, as one might expect. And then, of course, the fourth seal really deals with a specific area of the earth, 1/4 of it, as we are told. in which death and Hades were going to rule over, and however long that takes them to ultimately take out everybody, every negative unbeliever, because that's what that seal concerns it with, that is in what we might call the Western Hemisphere. And so the West is going to go down because of thermonuclear war and possibly other factors like biological and chemical weapons. There's no reason to suspect that these might not be used. If I was going to attack my enemy, I believe I would probably use everything at my disposal, and particularly if I was going to take a one-shot risk that I could take him out completely without any fear of reprisals, I would not, you know, those weapons you hold back really aren't all that valuable. As they say in the football world, a timeout at the end of the game doesn't help you. So you need to use them, and I don't have any reason to believe that they're not going to use them. So a quarter of the earth is going to be adversely impacted by this, as we have seen. And then we had kind of a parenthetical seal, and we're going to see this works also for the trumpets as well. There is a series of 4, 2, and 1. And that's what we're going to have in the trumpets as well, just as we have in the bowls. The first four bowls are in some ways interconnected. Then you have a sort of a parenthetical one. You have the fifth and the sixth. And now the sixth seal, as we noticed, went from, again, the destruction of Babylon right up to the second advent. And so then as we get into the trumpets, the seventh seal itself is actually comprised of seven trumpets, and we'll have to deal with those. And as far as I can tell, the seven seals begin to be opened, or pardon me, the seven trumpets begin to blow just before the midpoint, and so the seven trumpets really cover only the latter half, as we will see. Now we're dealing in chapter 7 with a bit of parenthetical information. Now this is put in here chronologically in a certain way, i.e., John wrote these and was given this revelation in this order, and so he records it in this order. It doesn't mean the events happen in this order during Daniel's 70th week. Again, as I've said, you've got this massive picture frame with all these events, and we just got to figure out where the pieces go. And in that regard, this book is somewhat different than some of the other prophetic books, which tended to deal in a linear progression. There's basically 7 years of human history here covered between chapter 6 and chapter 19. And we just have to figure out why it's here and here and here and what he's talking about. Well, we're going to get into the second thing now, this parenthetical section, that's going to deal with these 144,000 Jews. And they are sealed as Antichrist appears. They are sealed early on. In the beginning of Daniel's 70th week. This seal, or this is not actually a seal, this is a parenthesis between the seals, but this is, quote, before the seventh seal is even opened. And so this whole section is, again, as we will point out, parenthetical, and this is, as we pointed out in the outline to this, fairly consistent through this book, that you'll get a progression, then a parenthesis that fills something in, then you'll get another progression. And so, again, all we have to do is figure out where he's at in terms of the story, and which portion of the story this actually governs. So chapter 7 here, verse 1, after I saw this, or after this I saw, rather, four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. After these things, literally, or after this is a meta, the preposition with the accusative of houtos, the near demonstrative pronoun. After this. Now this is the only time this phrase is used in Revelation. Now it uses the phrase meta tuto, which is after these things, in the plural, a number of times to introduce digressions, we might say. But here is the only time, and so this is his way of, this is a marker here that this is a pretty unique event. This is grammatically one of the things, I mean, you might look at these words in English, after this, okay, so what, after this. After this only means that it's after what he has seen previously. It doesn't mean that this is advancing the chronology of Daniel's 70th week, per se. And that's what we have to keep before us, that sometimes when John speaks, he's advancing the chronology, and other times he's just saying, well, the next thing I saw was, and then thus and such, fill in the blank. So after this, here, and this does introduce a parenthesis, I saw, aorist indicative of Idon, which really is an old form of horao, the verb to see, I saw four angels, accusative masculine plural of the adjective tesseres, That means four. And then, of course, the word angelos, angels. I saw four angels standing. Perfect active participle of histemi, the verb to stand. But in the perfect, the idea is having taken a stand. Or having been stationed, maybe, is even another idea of this. But as we will see, the perfect tense in this regard, particularly with stative verbs like standing and things like that, when I say I'm standing, it pretty well covers it whether I use an aorist or a perfect or a present. Doesn't really matter. In some ways, the act is itself what it is when someone is standing. So here, obviously, one of the things we see is the idea of standing has to do with ready for service. That when people are, we might say, at attention. So having taken their positions upon is preposition epi, with the, again, adjective tesseres. And then you've got this noun with the definite article, hey, gonia. Or gonia, actually. It's gonia, I'm sorry. Hey, gonia. The word literally means a corner. And I mean, we know what a corner is. You can go out here to the street and you go down to the corner. It's where four things come together. Or actually, more literally, two things come together and become four. Here, this is figuratively, it's used of the directional extremes on planet Earth. North, south, east, and west. And so, the point is that we recognize, and this is one of the challenges we'll get in this, because people like to argue about this. Well, that isn't scientific. Okay, big deal. We all know what it means. It's not as though the Bible has to be a textbook on science at all. It's not designed to be a textbook on science. However, where it does touch scientific information, it is correct. And this is a normal human idiom. Get a break. It's a normal human idiom that people use. And people use idioms all the time, and they're not trying to be literal. As I pointed out, we'll deal with that when we get into this. But we have here the four corners of the earth. And so if you take the earth is a globe, obviously it's a sphere. We know what it is. But if you divide it three-dimensionally, if you like slice it in half and then slice it in half the other way, you have four distinct quadrants. And we all know what those would be. And so we might say, this is the, whatever, the northeast quadrant, this is the northwest quadrant, southeast, and southwest. So we understand what's going on here, I hope. I won't belabor this point with you. Hopefully you're not a wooden-headed literalist that has to have everything spelled out exactly in the proper words. Because this is simply just what it is. It's an idiom to describe the extremes. So on the four corners of the earth, definite article plus the word gay, hey gay. Holding back the four winds of the earth. Holding back is a present active participle of krateo, actively holding them back and currently holding them back. At the time John sees this, that is. And now this occurs, this event we're going to place just following the rapture. And so there is a sense here, immediately we're told, that nothing's going to happen until God's ready for it to happen. And we'll deal with that in this concept of winds. So holding back the four, and then you got tesseres again, the four winds, animas. Obviously, an anemometer is an instrument that measures wind. This is another one of the words out of Greek that we use pretty regularly. Here the word often is used to very strong or gusty winds. Now, here in this context, and this is the real challenge in doing this book, and if you read any good commentary on Revelation, it will tell you. The real challenge in doing this book is what to know what is figurative and what is literal. Are these, well, first question any interpreter would have to ask, is are these literal winds? Are we talking about, like the wind that's blowing outside today out of the north, making it fairly chilly outside, we might say. And those of us with poor circulation probably think it's downright cold. But that we understand what the wind is and what direction it comes from. Well, the first question you would have to ask as you try to interpret this is, are these winds literal? Are they holding back the literal winds from blowing? And I don't think they are, and we'll show you why. Here, clearly, it's a figure for divine judgment, as we will see. You could also see Revelation 6:13, as we pointed out, when the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. And there, clearly, it's a figure for a divine activity in terms of judgment. And in effect, what this passage is telling us is that these judgments aren't going to begin until God's ready for them to begin. And he controls them all. And so that's one of the challenges, is to recognize, because, I mean, the easiest thing to do as a believer is to get focused on what you see. Because what you see on a day-in, day-out basis will depress the hell out of you at various levels, whether it's what's going on out there in the world, sometimes even what other believers are doing, sometimes even what you're doing yourself will depress you. And so we have to be focused on the unseen things, and that's the challenge, is to remain that way. Because in the unseen world, we recognize God's in control. But we look at our world, and it seems as though God's not in control. As a matter of fact, I was reading one of the thing today, and people were asking, you know, some dramatic thing happened, and this guy's asking, where was God? Like, it's all God's fault that these bad things happen. So immediately the human race wants to blame him. Well, God is in control, and you have to remember that. That's a challenge sometimes, believe me. And God knows what he's doing. You have to remember that, and that's a challenge sometimes too, believe me. And again, for most of us, it doesn't seem as though the charge of the elephant is the big deal. It's those 50 million mosquitoes that are hovering around us that are multiplying and breeding rapidly. And they quickly become 100 million mosquitoes, and the cloud is on you. So there you go. So here we got God in charge, though, of this. And one of the things this book is obviously designed to do is to allay believers' concerns and to help them recognize, you know, no matter what's going on out there, God knows about it. And he's aware of it, and he's either allowing it or directly doing it, one way or the other. So here we have, in order that, the four winds of the earth, and then here we have the purpose. You've got Hina May, and actually this is a negative purpose clause, H-I-N-A, with the negative May, M-E. Mm-hmm. It's a negative purpose clause, and usually we translate it by the word lest or except. Or here they've translated it strictly as a purpose clause, so that no wind, in order that not, literally is what you have in the Greek, so that no wind, and this word, this verb here, P-N-E-O, the present active subjunctive, lest any wind blow, that's the verb to blow is ne-o, and then you got the word onomos again for wind, lest any wind might blow upon the earth, preposition epi, plus hege again. Or, conjunction here, metet, or on the sea. In other words, judgment is not going to strike the land or the sea or any tree. You might say, well, what's the big deal? So the trees get judged. What's that worry us? Well, we're going to find out it makes a huge difference. The world's going to really, as much as the tree huggers out there, the hippies, want to protect the forests and all of that, but we're going to find out that at a certain level they recognize certain things are correct. The human race needs this stuff. And we're not going to take it to the extreme. They would, obviously. But the point is, these things are quite valuable in terms of resources. So here you have, upon the earth, or upon the sea, and then meta again, or upon, and then literally what you have is the adjective pos, with the anarthrous dendron, which means every tree. That's the word for tree, D-E-N-D-R-O-N. So it's not going to, and we would translate it in this context because it's a negative, any tree. So it's not going to, but the idea is it won't touch every tree. In other words, every tree is exempt from this, at least at this point. And obviously one of the things you should get out of this verse right away, I mean the logical reading of this is that if God is withholding judgment, it only appears from this verse that he's withholding it momentarily. And we're going to see that that is the case. He's only withholding it momentarily. Okay, point one, as we pointed out in the outline to this book, chapter 7 forms a parenthesis that provides us supplemental information without advancing the narrative chronologically. Two, further, its placement between the opening of the sixth and seventh seal demands that it be treated as an interruption to the chronological flow. And again, when we talk about chronology, there's two chronologies that you've got to keep before you when you're doing this book. One is the actual chronology of the book. which really deals, again, once we get to chapter 6 through 19, which really deals with 7 years. Then there's what we might call John's chronology, how this is coming to him, how he's recording it, the order in which it happens, that John has a chronology that day as he's writing. And so, in a sense, when we say here, this doesn't advance, in this case, it doesn't advance this chronology at all. In fact, it backs up and recapitulates, which is a regular feature of a parenthesis in anything. Very often it's used to recapitulate and fill in other salient points that might not have been addressed. But obviously in John's chronology, he says after this. Why? After what? After he saw the sixth seal opened and all that that entailed, then this thing came to him. So that's where we're headed here. And again, to try to keep that before you, that there are two chronologies here, one of the day of the Lord itself, or beginning Daniel's 70th week, and then the one in which John functions. Well, three, the chapter is comprised of information with respects to two groups that of believers that lived during Daniel's 70th week. One group composed entirely of Jews, and the other composed of a multitude from every nation, tribe, people, and language. And that clearly is much more cosmopolitan in nature and designed to be so. And those words have to be taken for what they mean. That people come out of various cultures and all of this and nations around the world. The only question becomes, is that group, nation, tribe, tongue, and people, is that technical for Gentiles only as opposed to Jews? Because the Jews here are treated clearly as a separate group, certainly, at one level. Or does that group is that group have Jews in it as well? And we'll have to deal with that at some point. At this point, the best thinking I've got on it, from what I've got any input from other people, is that this really refers primarily and predominantly to Gentiles. But we'll have to deal with that as we go. So four, the very fact that they are dealt with together in this parenthesis is a clear indication that there is some relationship between them. This has always been, in some ways, a puzzle for many interpreters. Why these two groups? Why are they placed side by side, and why here? Well, hopefully we can answer that as we go through this. Five, the fact that this interlude is placed here is designed to highlight the difference between the elect and the masses of negative volition that characterize Daniel's 70th week. As we saw, the rhetorical question, point six, that was asked at the end of chapter six is now answered here, as believers are contrasted with their unbelieving counterparts. And of course, this is, as we pointed out, under the doctrine of separation, there is an eternal separation that God is going to effect, whether people like it or not. Everybody who is negative unbelievers are going to be eternally separated from all believers. That's a fact. And negative volition, of course, is not popular with God. Certainly not negative volition at God consciousness. He will allow them the freedom to make their decisions to reject grace and the plan of God and his son and all that. But he's going to enforce a separation on them. He's going to give them what they wanted, a world without God. And so that eternal distinction is going to be maintained. Well, we keep seeing these distinctions pop up in the scripture. In chapter 6, see here at the end, we see the attitude and actions of the kings of the earth, the great men and the commanders, the rich and the strong. What's not told us there, but you have to be able to figure out if you've got some doctrine, is that this is the negative of the earth. These are the negative unbelievers out there and their attitude towards what's happening to them. Now we're going to have that contrasted with the positive of that time. And will there be positive? This is one of the theological questions people have asked over the years. I remember when I was a fundy, one of the things they used to try to do to scare people in that down that aisle at the Baptist church was, you better come tonight because the rapture could occur. And you can't be saved after that. Well, that's a lie. I mean, I wouldn't want to go through Daniel's 70th week, don't get me wrong. But that's a lie. You can be saved after the rapture. It's not going to be a fun time to live in, and you probably are going to wish you had believed before the fact, but to tell people they can't be saved is stupid. And this whole chapter totally blows that theory apart, that massive numbers of people are going to be saved. In fact, some have suggested more people will numerically be saved during Daniel's 70th week than have been saved throughout the course of the church age, and that's a lot of people. But again, you're looking at a situation with a lot of people on the planet, too. You're talking some massive numbers here. So this is here. We're going to see there are people who can stand in the day of his great wrath. The ones, for instance, who have the seal of God on their foreheads will be able to. They'll be able to endure all this. God will protect them. So, 7, this chapter also contains the answer to the questions about whether or not the gospel will be proclaimed during Daniel's 70th week, i.e. it will, and whether or not people will be saved. They will. And so, granted, I mean, if you wanted to tell somebody, you really ought to, if you're considering salvation, you might want to do it in the church age. So you go out at the rapture. But to tell them, you know, you can't be saved or you won't be saved, that's incorrect. And I remember another little spin the Fundies used to put on it when I was in the Baptist church. They'd say, well, you might be saved, but the problem is right now you're hardening your heart, see? And then after you want to get saved, you won't be able to. Well, there's no evidence of that either. Now, you can harden your heart, obviously, to the point where you are not going to change your mind. We recognize that. But to tell people, if you don't get saved right this minute, you never will make that decision. Well, that's Fundy claptrap, and that was just, it's scare tactics is all it is. And that was another whole deal with the Fundies, and I dealt with them at length, and I know, is the ends come to justify the means. You know, we want people to be saved and go to heaven, and it's in their best interest for them to be saved. So however we go about it is really okay. And that would include lying for God. Well, this quickly becomes nothing more than religious oppression, the type law likes of which the Catholic Church did during the Middle Ages during the Inquisition. We recognize that people need to go to heaven, and to them, going to heaven meant being a member of the Catholic Church. So therefore, you join the church and swear allegiance to the Pope, or we kill you for your own good. What? This is for my good you're doing all this. I don't feel very blessed at the moment. Well, this is the way the Fundies treat unbelievers out there, and even believers. They'll run roughshod over them. And all in the name of God, and all because they know better. Look, I recognize it's difficult to watch people doing stuff that's stupid. I see it. And it's difficult to watch. But you know what? I can't go out there and twist their arm in the name of God. I'm here to help you, brother. And if it involves breaking both your arms, I'm willing to do that. Well, no, that's inappropriate. So this comes out of this that, one, there are a lot of people going to be saved during Daniel's 70th week. So just because somebody isn't a believer now doesn't mean it's over for them at the rapture. They'll still have opportunities. Now, they may reject right up to the very end. They may reject right up to the point the bombs drop here. At that point, it'll be too late for them. But as long as anyone is alive, there's a chance for them. And that's why that's the whole principle of grace. Grace doesn't run out till you're dead. Then that's the time for making changes is over. So again, this answers the question. One, the gospel will be proclaimed. And two, a lot of people will be saved. 8, while the church has been delivered from that hour of testing. The first group is comprised of people, or is composed rather, of people that will be delivered through Daniel's 70th week. And there's two distinct Greek prepositions for that. Ek with the ablative, out from, has the idea of this, and it can even mean, it has, and sometimes it functions like apo in that regard, depending on what's in view, what's the important thing they're stressing. And then you have deliverance through something, i.e. you start here, go through it, and come out on the other side. That's dia plus the genitive, through something. And so this is what's going to happen. So let's pretend this is Daniel's 70th week. We're delivered out from it, i.e., and this is where a lot of people don't even address this. We're delivered out from it on this side of it. That is, we're delivered from it before it even starts. That's how we're delivered out from it. And generally, when you see ek and apo diagrammed in Greek grammars, you'll see them look just like this. This is the way they do it. But here's what ek means in that context of Revelation 3:10. I will deliver you from that hour about to try the whole earth. It means from, as in before that hour even starts. You're going out. Now, these people are delivered through the hour. They go through the entire 7 years, and they're delivered every step of the way. And so they're safe, as we will see. Well, 9, John uses the phrase here, meta tuto, after this, or the plural after these things. here several times in this book to introduce a new unit of material. This phrase, however, is not temporal, and it does not advance the chronology of the book as a whole. All John's saying is, after I saw this, then I saw this. It advances his chronology in that sense. It's the next step for him. But he's not saying this is the next step in the chain of events that's going to occur. And that's, if you can keep that straight, hopefully that makes sense. 10, however, it does advance John's chronology, signifying that this refers to a new vision that he saw next in sequence. But it does not indicate that it follows chronologically the next or the previous section. So what we have, and this has always been a problem to interpreters, it's clear to them that if you read chapter 6 carefully, and you get down to the end of it, where the mountains are shaken and the islands are shaken out of their places, that this is at the very end of Daniel's 70th week. And so if this next chapter is a chronological step forward, this poses huge problems. And many of them cannot reconcile. So they still think it's a chronological step forward from there. It's not a chronological step forward from there. It's only a chronological step for John in terms of the sequence that he observed these things. 11, for the first time in this book, we are introduced to the fact that angels are going to be quite active in Daniel's 70th week, working to fulfill the will of God with respect to this planet and those on it. Four angels are observed in some way withholding judgment from the earth, while a single angel announces that an unspecified number of angels will be involved in sealing the 144,000. And we're going to get that in the next verses, but if you look ahead, you see another angel ascending, verse 2, from a rising sun, and he calls out to the first four angels and gives them instructions, saying, do not harm the earth or the trees until we, well, who are the we? Him and some other angels. We're not told how many. Maybe there's 144,000 of them. I don't know. It doesn't say. Maybe there's one angel per person. But certainly an unnamed group of angels here then have to go out and do this sealing and what all is involved in that, and we'll cover that as we get to it. But just to express to you here, there's a group of angels already involved right here, the four plus the one plus another unspecified group. 13, the Greek term standing is a perfect participle, which is designed to communicate the fact that they have been stationed there by God, i.e. generally the perfect tense signifies action in past time, with existing results. When I say he was standing out in the street, I mean, obviously he had to get there, and he could have been standing there for some time, but the reality is what I'm focusing on is he's standing there now, whatever tense I use in a sense. So 14, the emphasis here, as it is with many stative verbs are verbs that denote a state, like standing or sitting, that kind of thing. Is not the past fact that they were stationed there, but the present reality, as accurately expressed by the English present tense. In effect, that the results have become the act, we might say. I know some of this may seem technical, and it is, I understand that, but I have to deal with it for my own conscience, and if you don't get anything out of it, I'm sorry. But I have to deal with it to the best of my ability, and these things have to be explained, at least so I can have a good conscience and continue to have a good conscience and move on. 15, the next phrase, the four corners of the earth, has created a great deal of controversy, causing people to denounce the unscientific, quote, nature of the Bible. 16, while critics will commonly point to several passages that refer to the four corners of the earth, such as Isaiah 11:12. They often fail to grasp that this is a colloquialism, an idiom, that is still used today to portray the four compass extremities of the planet. And so Isaiah 11:12 uses it. And this phrase is used in both the Old and New Testament then. And so people can denounce God all they want. He's unscientific. Well, he's not, as we'll point out. We'll take up for God today. We got nothing better to do, I guess. And he will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And that just means from every direction. Don't get too technical. This isn't rocket science, as Emerald would say. It's just the four corners. It's just the four compass points. And we talk about the compass points. They don't terminate anywhere, by the way. When you're on a globe, when you're on a sphere, if you head in a direction, you never get there. You can't say, well, I'm at east now. There's no point on the planet where is east. East continues to go all around. It's an infinite line around the globe. So is west, so is north, so is south. So when we talk about compass points, we recognize that there's no compass points per se. And hopefully we know Santa doesn't live at the North Pole. Well, 17, people regularly use idioms to express themselves. And these are not to be taken as strict scientific terms to express various concepts, such as the rising and setting of the sun. 18, hopefully most believers have sufficient education to recognize that the earth rotates on its axis around the sun. And this produces the visual illusion of the sun rising and setting. But, you know, poetry wouldn't be what it is if you had to say that. Can you imagine a poet trying to write this? You know, he wants to talk about the glories of a sunset. And he has to say the glories of the earth visually rotating around the sun on its axis, producing the illusion of sunrise, which doesn't really exist. Kind of ruins the poem, doesn't it? You can't even do that in haiku. So, good grief. Well, 19, this is the problem with the wooden-headed literalist. He takes every comment at face value and does not allow for normal and natural human expressions. See, I bet you somebody got up today and said it's freezing. Come on, somebody did, didn't they? You thought it if you didn't say it. I'm freezing to death simply means that it is cold. It's not designed to say that I'm literally becoming a block of ice. And people have to allow for this. I mean, you can't just, if you're going to, you know, judge every word out of every person's mouth, one, you've got a lot more energy than I do. And two, you're going to drive yourself and everybody else nuts. Because, look, people talk in idioms all the time. And if somebody says it's freezing today, don't jump down their throat and point out to them that it is not below 32 degrees. See, then it would be technically freezing. So if they're cold, they're cold. That's their way of saying I'm cold. I'm starving to death. I'm hungry. I'm not literally starving to death. I mean, it's going to take a while. I don't look like one of those emaciated Ethiopians or anything, you know. Take me a while to starve, as it would some of us. You know who you are. So that's the point. I mean, we say I'm starving to death. It just means I'm hungry. Don't pound people on the head for that kind of stuff. I'm starving. It's freezing. I could eat a horse. They're not being literal. What, hooves and all? No, it's just an idiom. It's the way people talk. Cut them some slack, for goodness sake. You might say something stupid occasionally in your life, too. But we'll try and not grace you out if you do, and not point it out. So these are the way people talk, and and this is no more unscientific, saying the four corners of the earth, than it is to say I'm freezing to death. It's not designed to communicate. It's designed to communicate a point, not literally. So 20, while we have clearly taught that the Bible is not designed to be a textbook for science, now we're not going to take the Bible and teach it as a scientific textbook. We have also maintained that when the Bible touches on scientific information, it is completely accurate. And 21, the critics of the Bible argue that such passages as this one contributed to the erroneous idea that the earth was flat, having four distinct corners. And so people read this verse and they conjure up an image in their head of a two-dimensional earth with four corners. It's a big square, and we all know they warned Columbus, you'll sail off the edge. I don't know where you would have gone. I guess you'd just fall out into space or something. But they viewed the earth. They must have viewed the earth. I mean, perhaps it had some depth to it. But primarily, they would have had to view it, you know, as something like that. A flat, four-cornered object. A square. Well, 22, however, Isaiah wrote during the 8th century B.C., and he was well aware of the fact that the earth was round. Isaiah 40:22 deals with that. And the ancients were not idiots. See, this is another thing that evolution has created an illusion of. And they've created the illusion that man was evolving. And, you know, they have their evolutionary progression of man. You've seen the pictures, right? Starts out as a monkey, and then he gradually gets taller and more erect. And then pretty soon he's Homo erectus. And but in between that, you've got Piltdown Man and, you know, blah, 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 and Neanderthal Man and Cro-Magnon Man. And, you know, Cro-Magnon Man had the sloping forehead that proved he was a mental defective. And all of that, and so they've done all this, which suggests, in fact, of course, that men weren't very smart, and you see them portrayed like in these National Geographic specials, and they can't speak, they're not sure what fire is, and, you know, they sit around and grunt, and, you know, all that. And yet, strangely enough, as man graduated, you know, from being an ape to a human, he figured out he should wear clothes. Where'd that come from? The monkeys never wore clothes. The most normal ones now don't. So where did man get that one from would be my good question. Clothing evolved? How did they figure out they needed clothing? Well, the Bible tells us how they figured it out. It's pretty simple. But anyway, you have man, and he's portrayed as stupid and ignorant and can barely handle his surroundings. I mean, he's living in fear of life or death. It's survival of the fittest. The earth is portrayed as being this very wild place that men were lucky to even be alive in. And it was not that way at all. Nothing could be further from the truth. The ancients were exceedingly intelligent. There's no question. I mean, let's assume God shows up at your house today and says, I want you to build an ark. Could you do it? An ark that, by the way, survived incredible forces. Could you do it? Oh, and you get no modern power tools either, by the way. There's no Black and Decker for you, no workmate. You got to go out and take this stuff down and build it yourself, by your hands, with whatever tools you can fashion. I'd say Noah was fairly resourceful. And he must have been incredibly intelligent. And to portray these people as just barely able to survive, I mean, it's just nonsense. Well, Isaiah 40:22, it is he who sits above the vault of the earth. And the idea here is the word vault actually means circle in the Hebrew. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth. Well, Isaiah knew the earth was round. This was, you know, circa 7-something B.C. Couldn't other people have figured it out? And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. Who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to rule in, or to dwell in, rather. So again, this is not, ancient man was not as stupid as he's portrayed. And they knew the earth was round, believers did anyway. But yeah, did unbelievers get corrupted in their knowledge because of their stupidity and negative volition? Well, sure. Sure they did. 23, further, if one divided the earth in half from north to south and a half from east to west, it would divide the sphere into four distinct quadrants. And 24, that is very likely how we are to take the word gunia, which would refer to the four quadrants that were formed by such a division. The word corners simply means something where two things come together. And so to say the four corners of the earth is not unscientific or wrong. Again, it's an idiom. Deal with it. So 25, the phrase, the four corners of the earth, is designed to speak of global authority and the fact that the sovereignty of God extends to every portion of the planet. 26, the present active participle of krateo, the verb for holding, has the sense of restraining, preventing, or holding something back. It really has to do with the hand, to have something under the power of the hand, so that you're controlling it, in effect. And controlling is a good thing here. I mean, if we say, and when they say they're holding back, you could substitute the word controlling without any injustice to what the text means. They're controlling the four winds of the earth. Now, what, and we'll have to deal with that. So 27, this participle, like the previous one, standing, stresses ongoing action. And the phrase may be translated standing firm and restraining, or standing firm and controlling would also communicate the four winds of the earth. In other words, the winds don't overpower them. They're standing their post. They're not being affected by them. And they control them, in fact. 28, while we are not told why the angels need to hold the winds back, the clear implication is that the winds are dangerous and pose a threat to the land, sea, and trees. 29, since this passage focuses on the disasters that will befall the earth, sea, and trees, This demands that we place this event before the second, third, and fourth seals. And this is how we arrive. Okay, chronologically, where does this event have to go in Daniel's 70th week now? That becomes the next exegetical question. Okay, we've got this event. When did this happen? As per se, I mean, we might say, when does this happen in the big picture? And so, clearly here, the earth hasn't been affected at this point. And no, I don't think anyone in their right mind would say that warfare would not, and global warfare, would not dramatically affect the earth. It certainly would. And we saw this deal about famine. And clearly the economies of the world have been impacted. The agricultural system of the world has been impacted. So we would have to place it. We're forced to place this before any of that happens. Because none of the judgments have fallen as of yet. And we'll deal with that more because this gets into the issues of chapter 8, which follows, and chapter 9 as well, but specifically 8. So 30, this is based on the fact that famine, warfare, and plagues would definitely affect the physical environment in a massive way. And it said, okay, in effect, what this verse says is they're not allowing the physical environment to be impacted. And okay, so then this must occur chronologically again in Daniel's 70th week before any some of these other things happen. So that's how we figure out where to place it, is you have to pay attention to the detail and look at it. Okay, well, let's see, is this, when does this occur? And you have to put it in there. 31, therefore, this parenthetical section must precede the events that are described by seals 2, 3, 4, and 6. 32, this is the reason that we place it chronologically at the outset of Daniel's 70th week, which will be further confirmed by the fact that none of the winds of destruction are allowed to blow on the planet before these 144,000 Jews are sealed. And that is specifically the content of verse 3. Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed. Now after that, you can harm them. But up until that time, no. So we've got to seal these people first. And then you can let them fly. So 33, the first question that must be addressed, again, as we pointed out, is whether or not these four winds are to be taken as literal winds, or are they figurative for something else? 34, some interpreters have taken the winds to be literal, since they suggest that they refer to the bizarre weather patterns that will become the norm in Daniel's 70th week. Weather is going to be dramatically impacted during this period, as we might understand. We're going to get some, there's at least a couple of times where severe hailstorms are mentioned. And we know that is, we've had them, you have them here during the summer, and you recognize that the weather can get pretty violent. I mean, scary type violent. I know fear is a sin. But you're in an airplane and suddenly, you get in a thunderstorm and it drops about 10,000 feet. You'll get a little bit of fear going. You won't have to even think about it. I like to, drop, 10 feet and giving it this way, side to side, and people are just bursting into tears on the plane. I mean, I saw that once. They'll scare the daylights out of you. Well, storms can get violent enough to scare people. That's a fact. You say, well, it's wrong being scared. Okay, I'll tell them that. I know it's wrong being, I know it's a sin. You have to recognize that and deal with it. But I'm saying things can get pretty frightening pretty quick. And we've seen it here in Florida. I mean, and we don't even live in Tornado Alley, although we get our fair share of them. So again, are they literal? Well, the weather pattern is going to be dramatically impacted for a number of reasons that we will detail as we go through this. 35, their position is supported by the fact that the weather will be impacted by the events of Daniel's 70th week and by the direct action of the two witnesses, as in chapter 11, verse 6. They have the power to shut up the sky. In other words, they can cause a drought, no rain, in order that rain may not fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have power over the waters to turn them to blood. That's a neat trick. And to smite the earth with every plague as often as they desire. Also, if you back up, I didn't put it in here, but there's one in chapter 8 that I found after this. Verse 5, after this angel throws this fiery censer, or the fire from the censer to the earth, there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. And the first sounded, verse 7, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. Well, that sounds like a weird weather event to me. And it is one, as we'll see. And also chapter 16, verse 8. And you know when you're getting hail that it's a pretty severe storm. Everybody pretty well recognizes that, I think. 16:8, and the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and it was given to it to scorch men with fire. That's different than what it's doing right now, trust me. And also verse 21, and huge hailstones about 100 pounds each. Hey, what if they were only 95? Would it severely matter? What if they're 110? They're about 100 pounds, give or take. Came down upon men, and men blasphemed God. Well, if one hit you directly, I don't think you'd be blaspheming God. I think you're going to be a little greasy spot in the pavement. Because these things reach incredible speeds as they're coming to the planet. And if you've ever been hailed on, and I've told you I have, it's not fun. And they weren't near 100 pounds that were hitting me. More like, you know, little pieces of peas throwing at you. But that was bad enough. Well, 20 to 36, however, from a cursory study of the rest of this book, it is clear, rather, from a cursory study, that the term winds is never used again. If you check this word out in Revelation, you'll find out onomos is only used, it's not used after this chapter. So if they're literal winds, that poses a problem. I mean, you would expect that you would hear about them again, especially if they're damaging, destructive winds. We would hear about them. And the judgments that devastate the planet have nothing to do with earthly breezes, tornadoes, hurricanes, etc. Those aren't the sources of the judgments. Now, not that God has never used a storm to judge a people or a place. He has, as we know. But we're not. That's not what's going to be detailed here for us as we get into this. I haven't seen anything in here about a cyclone yet. So 37, therefore, the only interpretation that this term allows in this context is a figurative one, one that was common to the Old Testament and Jewish apocalyptic literature. 38, wind is used figuratively in the Old Testament to symbolize the concept of divine judgment. Psalm 77:18. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Here we're dealing with the remembrance of things that God has done in the past. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. The way was in the sea, and this deals with, of course, the deal at the Exodus, but clearly the wind there was a judgment in the sense of a positive thing as a part of the Red Sea. And we're told that that was done by wind. And he redeemed his people through this powerful act. Also 104:4. Now, some of these will be judgments in a negative sense, obviously, as you would expect. This is sort of a general term. He makes the winds his messengers. As we pointed out here, the word winds is not literal. And clouds his chariot. These have to deal with his angelic host and the way he uses them. Proverbs 1:27 also. Here's a more direct point in terms of divine judgment as pronounced on those who reject the principles of doctrine, as per verse 20 and following, that doctrine is available to those who will avail themselves of it, and people have, you know, other things to do. And even though it is around, people don't like, number one, people don't like being told they're wrong. That's one of the reasons they reject doctrine, is they don't want to be wrong. And that's something as a human being that you got to learn to get over and outgrow. You're going to be wrong. Get used to it. It's going to happen. You may like to think you're perfect. I'd like to think you're perfect, but you're not. Neither am I. Nobody is. And people are going to make mistakes. And this is one of the deals, verse 23, turn to my reproof. Reproof is being told that you're wrong. And doctrine tells us that we're wrong in certain areas, and we either orient to it or we continue to bow our neck and fight the tide and buck against it and let God know that we're still running the show. Well, that can happen and does. And then certain times, God's just going to lower the boom. And after a point, verse 25, you neglected all my counsel. You neglected my advice. I gave you sound advice about this, and you rejected it. You've heard it. You've heard it repeatedly. And you did not want my reproof. You didn't want to be told you're wrong. I will laugh at your calamity. That isn't very nice. I will mock when your dread comes. You know what dread is? That isn't just fear. Dread is intensive fear that just paralyzes you. And your calamity comes on you like a whirlwind. When distress and anguish come on you, and this is a figure in this context, obviously, for divine discipline and judgment on those that reject the truth. And so this is the challenge we face, we deal with an awesome God who will not tolerate our stupidity at a certain level. And he may let us run with it under his permissive will, but there comes a point at which he's going to jerk up the choke collar on you. And if you're running too hard in the opposite direction, you're going to go four legs up in the air. If you've ever seen a dog run to the end of a choke leash. I mean, I've seen them literally just run as hard as they could and land flat on their back as that thing tightened around their neck and boom, go up in the air and bam, flat on their back. And they're probably laying there thinking, you know, that wasn't very well thought out. Well, we can obviously do that sort of thing as well. And God will lower the boom. And people might think that what they're doing is secret and nobody knows about it. Oh, God knows. You may be able to fool the dummies in this Bible class, but God knows what you're doing. God knows your secrets that you think you're hiding so well. And if you want to reject the truth and run and do your little thing, and in opposition clearly to the doctrine you know and have been taught, God will catch up with you. And when he does, it won't be pretty. So this figure of a whirlwind here is the idea of a tornado or cyclone coming on you. Well, you believe me, if you've ever seen one of these, you don't want to be in them. Also, Proverbs 10:25. Here is a figure for divine destruction that removes the negative. When the whirlwind comes, when the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more. See, the judgments are going to come. And it's also kind of, as we'll see, there's another verse that just occurred to me we'll put in here. Isaiah 66:15 is the next one. For behold, the Lord will come in fire, and his chariots like the whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, and his rebuke with flames of fire. For the Lord will execute judgment by fire and by his sword on all flesh. And those slain by the Lord will be many. Well, no duh. Jeremiah 49 also, 32. And I believe this is in the context of here, verse 32, and it's another context of judgment. And their camels will become plunder, and the multitude of their cattle for booty. And I will scatter to all the winds those who cut the corners of their hair, and I will bring their disaster from every side, declares the Lord. So also here, verses 36 and 37, and I will bring upon Elam the four winds from the four ends of the heaven, and they shall scatter them to all these winds, and there will be no nation to which the outcasts of Elam will not go. And I will scatter Elam before their enemies and before those who seek their lives, and I will bring calamity on them. There, here clearly, the four winds that he's going to bring on them are a figure for calamity. Even my fierce anger, declares the Lord, and I will send out the sword after them, warfare, until I have consumed them. So here you have these four winds of judgment in effect, that come on Edom, calamity, and warfare are two of those winds. We're not told what the others all are, but the point is, this is designed to take them out. And also there's a concept in Matthew of the people that build their houses. Some people build on sand. Some people build on bedrock. You build wherever you like. But Matthew 7, 24 and following. But where you build certainly is going to make a difference in terms of how your house is going to stand up. And as we pointed out, 1 Corinthians 3 talks about the building materials for your house. And we'll deal with that under the principle of sound doctrine. But here the wise man builds on the rock, the foolish man builds on the sand. Then the rains descended, the flood came, and the winds blew. Now, the winds obviously are a figure for overt trouble and calamity, the storms of life, we might say, that come against people. Whether they are directly sent by God or they just occur as a normal feature of life is not really relevant. Okay, well, I'm sorry, we have gone over, so I got about 10:48, so why don't we be back here at 10 after today and be ready to go. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break.
What happened to the Sooners last night, huh?